The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. If you have any questions or would like to become a sponsor of this program, or any other program, please contact our office at 919-832-5138. Okay, let's start off with the Everyday Miracles portion of Reader's Digest. There's a picture of a white man and an African-American man. It's a drawing. It's a painting rather than a photograph. And one is named Doug Kaufman. He's the Caucasian. And Jim McGee is the African-American. And they're in front of an old-style twin-engine airplane, basically what used to be called a C-47. As an Air Force pilot in Vietnam, Jim McGee flew 471 combat missions and earned 3 Distinguished Flying Crosses. When he served as the U.S. ambassador to Zimbabwe from 2007 to 2009, he defied the murderous regime of then-President Robert Mugabe, who threatened him with expulsion. But after Jim retired from the Foreign Service, he encountered a problem no amount of courage or diplomacy could solve. In 2017, he found himself exhausted during a trip to South Africa. When he came home to Sarasota, Florida, he went to see a nephrologist. "The reason I was fatigued," Jim says, "was that my kidneys were gone." Jim, 69, immediately started dialysis 3 days a week, but his long-term prognosis wasn't good. A person his age on dialysis usually lives only about 4 years. Transplants are a long-shot alternative. The National Kidney Foundation estimates that 13 people die every day while waiting for a donor with the right blood and tissue types. Jim's wife, Shirley McGee, was a match, and his 37-year-old nephew, a police detective in great shape, also stepped up. But their kidney functions weren't strong enough. 4 family friends offered, but weren't a match. Desperate, Shirley had T-shirts made up that said, "I'm in need of a donor." Her husband would wear one whenever he went downtown to downtown Sarasota. No luck. Jim was so discouraged that in early 2018, he was even considering not attending a reunion of some Air Force buddies in Monterey, California. "I said, 'Is this really worth going out to Monterey to sit in dialysis for 2 days, Jim recalls. And my wife said, "Yeah, come on. You really want to see your friends." And boy, am I glad I made that decision. At a bed and breakfast in California, Jim reunited with 6 fellow airmen, including one he hadn't seen in nearly 50 years, Doug Kaufman. The duo had met when they were both learning Vietnamese in a 9-month immersion course at the Defense Language Institute in Monterey before they went overseas. Jim told Doug and his other comrades about his predicament. "I asked him what his blood type is, and he said O positive," says Doug, an author who lives in Eugene, Oregon. "Well, that happens to be my blood type. I was immediately thinking, gosh, I might be able to help." Doug, then 70, knew from regular visits to his doctor that he was healthy and vigorous. He also felt a strong bond with his band of brothers, even though he hadn't seen some of them in decades. Their connection went beyond the battlefield in ways most soldiers never experience. After entering the Air Force in the 60s and serving for 3 years, Doug decided to register as a conscientious objector, an unusual decision by an active-duty military person. He continued to serve while waiting for his case to be heard. In the meantime, a member of his unit wrote a letter supporting his petition to become a conscientious objector. "I've always appreciated that some of these fellows helped me during my time of need," says Doug, who won his case after a few months and reassigned to non-combatant status in the United States. "So I felt like this was a time that I could pay that ahead and continue that bond into the future," he says. But could he? When Doug confided to Shirley that he wanted to donate a kidney, she thanked him but said her guess was that doctors would tell Doug, as they had told her, "You're too old." "And I said, 'All I know is that I've got 2 really good kidneys, so I'd like to give this a go,'" Doug recalls. He immediately had his doctor send his medical records to Georgetown University Medical Center, where Jim was being treated. Within a month of their Air Force reunion, Doug was cleared for major testing. He flew to Washington, D.C. in mid-August, where he underwent 5 days of MRIs, EKGs, CT scans, and urinalysis, and more. Jim was grateful but didn't want to get his hopes up. "Until we heard those final results that, yes, you're an absolute match, I didn't want to get too crazy," Jim says, "because the letdown is so severe." The testing revealed not only Doug's tissue type matched Jim, but also that he had kidneys of a 35-year-old. His secret? I just lead a good, clean life, Doug says. Just the usual stuff to stay healthy. When the doctors gave him the okay to donate, Doug immediately called Jim, then asked for the first surgery date available. Jim and Shirley put their dog in the car and drove to Washington, D.C. On September 18, 2018, Doug and Jim sat side by side in a hospital gowns and adjoining beds. Doug went into surgery at 7:30 a.m. Jim followed at 9:30 a.m. By noon, they were both in the recovery room. The transplant was a success. It's pretty miraculous to be able to take an organ out of one person's body, a living organ, and put it in another person's body and have it work, Doug says. And there's nothing finer than knowing I've helped another person live a better and longer life. Great parenting blogs through history. 14 ways the wheel is making our kids lazy. Managing screen time. Are we letting our kids watch too many Glory Gladiator matches? Overcoming disappointment when your child's crusade fails. While switching to the Gregorian calendar, don't forget to schedule some me time. Your true stories in 100 words. After learning her friend had broken his arm, my 5-year-old daughter insisted on drawing him a picture. She sat at the table for an hour, coloring carefully, then handed me a piece of paper. It's very pretty, I said. I bet this will make him feel better. She smiled, and I wrote him a letter on the back. Oh, I turned the paper over to look at the back, which was covered in random letters and scribbles. What does it say? She shrugged. How would I know? I can't read. Man of the hour. When our car overheated in the middle of nowhere, the local tow truck driver hauled us into town, saying he was in a hurry. It was Good Friday, and everyone was going to church for the Easter pageant. Despite being in a rush, the driver found the right thermostat for our car and fixed our problem. While he worked, we sat in his office with his wife and kids, who were growing increasingly impatient. His family was definitely late for church, but the driver shrugged it off. They can't start without me, he said. I'm playing Jesus. That's cute. The luckiest penny ever. I never believed in lucky charms, but one day as I was mowing the lawn, I noticed a shiny object some 5 yards away. I stopped the lawn tractor to go see what had caught my eye. Just as I bent over to pick up the object, the tractor exploded behind me, knocking me off my feet. Later in the emergency room, my family told me that when I'd been brought in by the ambulance, they'd found a shiny penny close to my hand. I now believe in lucky pennies and stop to pick them up whenever I see them. I guess so. Unsolved. These 7 baffling mysteries have obsessed detective scholars and explorers for years. Are the answers out there somewhere? The Havana Syndrome. When diplomats serving in the American Embassy in Cuba complained of ailments caused by sound waves, the American government accused Cuba of dirty tricks. The Cuban ambassador to the United States denied the charges, and many in America believed him. So what caused the mysterious noises? Was it a malfunctioning listening device, or something as innocuous as crickets? Diplomatic crisis. Sickening noises. My tongue is malfunctioning here. In December 2016, a CIA officer checked into the American Embassy's health office in Havana, suffering from nausea, headaches, and dizziness. Days later, 2 more CIA officers reported similar ailments. By late 2018, the number grew to 26 Americans and 13 Canadians experienced nausea, hearing loss, vertigo, nosebleeds, and focusing issues. In all the cases, victims claimed that symptoms were triggered by a strange noise they'd heard at their homes or hotel rooms. One person said the noise was high-pitched, another described a beam of sound pointed into their rooms. Some insisted that the noise more closely resembled marbles rolling along the floor. The illnesses confounded medical experts. Doctors at the University of Pennsylvania, who examined some of the victims, diagnosed concussion-like symptoms but found no signs they'd suffered concussions. We know what you must be thinking. The Cuban government is up to something, right? The Cubans vehemently deny they're responsible, and many American investigators believe them. That's because they still don't know who or what made the victims sick. Was it a new type of weapon? The CIA claims it doesn't know of any weaponry that could cause these symptoms. What about ultrasound? One theory holds that a pair of covert eavesdropping devices placed too close to each other by Cuban agents may have inadvertently produced such a reaction, like the kind of feedback you hear when someone stands too close to a microphone. But the FBI has found no evidence to substantiate that argument. In fact, ultrasound is above the range of human hearing. Recording of the sounds from some of the victims only added to the confusion. Two scientists who studied the recordings believed they captured the sound of lovelorn male crickets. One of the scientists, Alexander Stubbs of the University of California, Berkeley, says the insects are incredibly loud. You can hear them from inside a diesel truck going 40 miles an hour on the highway. Still, the scientists had no idea why the sounds might lead to illness in humans. Maybe it was just nerves. Cuba is a high-threat, high-stress post, a former embassy official told ProPublica.org. Diplomats are warned that there will be surveillance. There will be listening devices in your house, probably in your car, too. For some people, that puts them in a high-stress mentality and a threat anticipation mode. True. But then how to explain what happened in China? In May 2018, American posted at the consulate in Guangzhou was diagnosed with the very same mystery illness. Ultimately, 15 Americans were evacuated. While seemingly airborne cause of these brain injuries is still a mystery, the fallout is clear. The Americans removed 60% of their diplomats from Cuba and expelled 15 Cuban diplomats from Washington, D.C. The mysterious sounds may well be the opening shots at a new kind of Cold War. The Bay of Jars. After hearing rumors of a sort of sunken treasure in Brazil's Guanabara Bay, Robert Marks, using a sonograph, made an unusual find, a cache of ancient pottery. Actually, they were Roman amphora and pots from the 3rd century. That raised authority question. Did the Roman cross the Atlantic 1,000 years before the Portuguese landed in Brazil? History rewritten. Roman ruins. It's not unusual to find junk in Brazil's Guanabara Bay, but what Robert Marks unearthed there in 1982 was an unusual kind of foreign matter. In an underwater field the size of 3 tennis courts located 15 miles from shore, there are remains of some 200 Roman ceramic jars, a few fully intact. According to Marks, a professional treasure hunter, the jars appeared to be twin-handled amphorae that were used to transport goods such as grains and wine from the 3rd century. But how did they get there? The first Europeans didn't reach Brazil until 1500. The Romans, who traded primarily in the Mediterranean port cities and the Middle East, had little incentive to invest in ships that could cross oceans. However, they did sail as far as India. Perhaps an untrained navigator lost his way in the storm, or maybe mutineers steered the ship westward. We may never know, nor are we likely to uncover more evidence. Brazil closed the Bay of Jars to further research in 1983 in an effort to deter looters. It said Marks claims the government didn't want the area exposed because finding Roman-era artifacts there would mean that, contrary to Brazil's official history, the Portuguese were not the first Europeans to reach the country. And the truth? It's resting 100 feet under the sea. The Pollock Sisters. In 1957, 3 children, including 2 sisters, were struck and killed by a car. A year later, the sisters' grieving mother gave birth to twins. When they learned to talk, the twins recounted stories about the accident of the only the dead girls would have known. Were Gillian and Jennifer Pollock the reincarnation of their sisters? Dr. Ian Stevenson, an expert in the paranormal, thought so. Mystical visions. Twin reincarnations. Identical twins Gillian and Jennifer Pollock were born on October 4, 1958, into a family scarred by tragedy. On a Sunday morning in May 1957, their older sisters, Jacqueline 6 and Joanna 11, had been struck and killed by a car while walking hand-in-hand to church in their small English parish of Hexham. When the twins arrived 17 months later, their grieving father, John Pollock, was certain they were actually his dead daughters reborn. Their mother, Florence Pollock, wasn't so sure, but then odd things happened. When the twins began talking, they would ask for the same toys their sisters had played with, toys they could not have known existed, because they had long been stored away. Though the Pollocks had left the Hexham when the twins were less than a year old, when they brought them in for a visit, their first, at age 4, the twins pointed out locations that had been meaningful to their sisters, but which the twins had never seen, such as the school the deceased sisters had attended and their favorite playground. Even more chilling were the twins' apparent memories of the deaths of their sisters. Up until the age of 5, each suffered reoccurring nightmares of being run over by a car. These nightmares sometimes evolved into daytime terrors. "The car! It's coming for us!" the twins would shriek at the mere sound of a car engine firing up in a small alleyway. Florence, a reincarnation skeptic, couldn't think of any rational explanation of how the twins had come to act out their sister's agonizing final moments with such apparent accuracy. "The blood's coming out of your eyes," Gillian would cry, cradling her sister's head tenderly in her arms as John and Florence looked on in horror. "It's where the car hit you." In 1963, Dr. Ian Stevenson, an expert on reincarnation of the University of Virginia, began to study the Pollock sisters, finding no evidence that the twins' apparent past-life memories had been manufactured or suggested by their parents. He concluded that it was virtually impossible not to believe they were living proof of reincarnation. The twins' memories gradually faded as they reached adolescence. Then, for a long period in their early 20s, Gillian experienced a series of visions of herself as a young child playing in a sandbox surrounded by gardens and an orchard. The Pollocks immediately recognized that their home in Wickham, the village where she'd lived with Joanna in the years before Jacqueline had been born. The catch? Gillian had never been to Wickham. Dyatlov Pass. 60 years ago, 10 Russian hikers set out on a 21-day winter trek. 9 were never seen alive again. The circumstances leading to their deaths remain a mystery, odd, since the group photographed much of the journey. Some think the government is covering up a radiation from an atomic blast. Others blame the Bigfoot. Today, a memorial stands at the friend's last campsite. Mass murder. Missing on a mountain. On January 23, 1959, 9 college students and their tour guide, Igor Dyatlov, set out on what was to be a 21-day hiking excursion through the Ural Mountains in the former USSR. On February 2nd, the group skied down Mount Otorten, English translation, Mount Don't Go There. On February 12th, when the group was scheduled to return home, only one student, 21-year-old Yuri Yudin, had arrived, and he had left the group early because of illness. When none of the others came home, a search party was organized. What the searchers found would haunt them. On February 26th, they discovered the hiker's tent. It had been sliced open from the inside. There were multiple pairs of snowy footprints, some made with bare feet, leading away from it. The bodies of the first two hikers were found wearing only underwear beneath a tall cedar tree, the flesh on their hands raw and pulpy from attempting to scramble up the trunk. The next two were found one day later and another hiker 6 days later, all showing signs of hypothermia. One had a fractured skull. It wasn't until the spring thaw began in May that the remaining four were discovered under 13 feet of snow in a ravine 82 yards from the cedar tree. Three had clearly died of severe internal injuries consistent with a tremendous physical impact comparable to a car crash, including skull and rib fractures, yet none bore visible external injuries. It was as if a deadly force had crushed them without having actually touched them. They all had apparently died on the 11th day of their trip, February 2nd, the last day on which any of them had written in their journals. The investigation continued, and in late May it took a shocking turn. Some of the hikers' clothing tested positive for radioactivity. On May 28, 1959, one day after the Soviet military got wind of the results of the radiation testing, the investigation was summarily closed. The official conclusion: the hikers had met with an unnamed overwhelming force. Of course, that abrupt announcement just intensified public speculation. Theories have included an explosion of a Soviet test missile, a UFO attack, hallucinogenic drugs, and even Bigfoot-like monster. "If I had a chance to ask just one question," said Yudin, the one surviving skier who died in 2018 at age 75, "it would be, what really happened to my friends that night?" Their memory, at least, lives on at the spot where they died. It is now called the Dyatlov Pass. Brain-sending sickness epidemic. From 1917 to 1928, 500,000 people were afflicted with a ghastly condition that could be part of the plot line of a horror film. The victims, very much alive and conscious, found themselves in inexplicably frozen states, their static bodies prisoners for their minds. Encephalitis lethargica, EL, a.k.a. the sleeping sickness, first appeared in Europe and quickly spread around the world, reaching epidemic levels in North America, Europe, and India by 1919. About a third of those stricken with the illness died. Of the survivors, nearly half eventually found themselves unable to physically interact with the world around them, all the while fully aware of their surroundings. Though occasionally capable of limited speech, eye motion, and even laughter, they generally appeared as living statues, totally motionless for hours, days, weeks, or years. The cause is unknown, but one theory is brain inflammation triggered by a rare strain of Streptococcus, the bacteria responsible for many sore throats each year. Science's best guess is that the bacteria mutated, provoking the immune system to attack the brain, leaving the victim helpless. None of this explains why the illness disappeared, only to resurface sporadically, be it in Europe in the 50s or in China 10 years ago, when a 12-year-old girl was hospitalized for 5 weeks with the disease. Are such occurrences the new normal, or are they that signs that EL could be planning something bigger any day? A 2014 analysis of 20 patients with symptoms remarkably similar to EL concluded that whatever ailed them is still prevalent. As such, history's so-called sleeping sickness remains the stuff of everyone's nightmares. D.B. Cooper. Flight attendant noted that Cooper was very well dressed and never took off his sunglasses. Before announcing he had a bomb in his attaché case, he calmly ordered a bourbon, then later asked for a second one. After his ransom demands were met, Cooper removed his tie, opened the door at the rear of the plane, which no longer could be done, obviously, and parachuted into the night, never to be seen again. The perfect crime. Vanishing hijacker. On the night before Thanksgiving 1971, a middle-aged man wearing a business suit boarded a commercial flight headed from Portland, Oregon to Seattle. He ordered a bourbon and soda, then calmly informed a flight attendant that he had a bomb in his attaché case. Having gotten her attention, he dictated the following message to the cockpit. I want $200,000 by 5 p.m. in cash. Put it in a knapsack. I want two backpack parachutes and two front parachutes. When we land, I want a fuel truck ready to refuel. No funny stuff, or I'll do the job. His boarding pass read Dan Cooper, but thanks to a communication error, the newspapers identified him more quickly as D.B. Over the next 2 hours, D.B. Cooper never took off his dark glasses. He nursed a second bourbon and waited patiently while the plane circled Puget Sound. He seemed rather nice, one of the hijacked flight attendants said later. On the ground, authorities scrambled to assemble the cash, parachutes, and a fuel truck, while the 36 passengers on board were led to believe the delay was routine. Upon landing in Seattle and receiving a knapsack full of $20 bills and four parachutes, Cooper released the passengers and all but four of the crew. He demanded to be flown on to Mexico City. But first he had one final instruction. He was to be left alone in the cabin. As the plane took off about 7:40 p.m., the four-person crew huddled in the cockpit. Per Cooper, the plane flew below 10,000 feet at a speed of slower than 200 knots, too low and slow for military jets to follow closely. Just 20 minutes later, a warning light flashed, indicating that the rear door had been opened and its staircase deployed. When the plane landed in Reno, Nevada, for refueling, the cabin was empty. Cooper had taken his knapsack and parachuted off into the night. Not a single witness saw him jump. He was never seen again. The ransom money, identifiably through serial number, was never used. Did Cooper plummet to his death? Did he survive only to somehow lose his knapsack? Or had the money been merely an afterthought, more of a means to spinning a story for the newspapers and for history? The FBI spent the next 9 years trying to find the answers. Then in 1980, a boy camping in rural Washington discovered three wads of cash along the banks of the Columbia River, which the FBI later identified as a portion of the ransom. But the trail remained cold until 2018, when a man named Carl Loren presented the FBI with an audio tape of his deceased friend Walter Recca confessing to being D.B. Cooper. Around the same time, a documentary filmmaker named Thomas Colbert was building a case that Cooper was actually a 74-year-old Robert Rackstraw. Rackstraw, former Special Forces paratrooper with 22 different aliases, had been a person of interest early on, but he was cleared in 1979. Colbert based his claim in part on a letter Cooper allegedly sent to the Washington Post that included the number 717171. In Vietnam, Rackstraw was of the 31st Regiment or 371s, 371st Regiment or 371s. Neither of those stories was enough to convince the FBI, which is why the case of D.B. Cooper remains the only unsolved skyjacking in the history of the American aviation. And here is one that's close to home. Sudden extension. the New World's lost colony. In March 1590, John White finally left England on a rescue mission to Roanoke Colony, the first permanent English settlement in North America. White was flown up Roanoke's governor, but he had been away gathering food and supplies to bring back to the struggling colony almost since its founding in 1587. The fate of Roanoke's residents had weighed heavily on his mind, and for good reason. Among those he left on the island, part of which is now North Carolina's Outer Banks, were his wife, his daughter, and his infant granddaughter. But when returned to Roanoke in 1590, he found nothing. The entire settlement was abandoned, its homes and battlements dismantled. It was as if the entire colony of 115 people had vanished. The only hint of Roanoke's fate was word Croatoan, carved into a fence post, and the letters CRO carved into a tree. Since White had instructed his colonists to carve a Maltese cross on a tree if they were moved by force, the absence of one gave White hope that the settlers had relocated to the nearby Croatoan Island, which was inhabited by the friendly Croatoan tribe. Unfortunately for White, he never did discover what happened to the colony. Soon after he arrived in Roanoke, a series of storms battered his ships, forcing his team back to their boats and eventually back to England. With an ocean once again between him and his family, a devastated White surrendered Roanoke to its unknown fate. So what happened to the lost colony? Perhaps they were abducted by Native Americans or moved inland to join a friendly tribe? Maybe they were slaughtered by Spaniards marking up in Florida or tried to sail back to London on their own and got lost at sea? Archaeologists have yet to come up with any sign of the lost colony, and time is running out. Shoreline erosion threatens the island, making the lost colony's outcome more of a missing each passing day. What do you call someone who devours books? A bookworm, of course. But that might be the wrong term after all. It turns out that the paper-eating insects chomping their way through your favorite novel are actually beetles and moths. In the early 20th century, scientist William R. Reneke identified more than 160 different insect species that can be destructive to books, and he found that they have discriminating taste indeed. Mexican book beetles prefer a fiber-rich diet of paper, cardboard, and wood shelving. Book lice like a little mold, and carpet beetles prefer leather, hair, and dry blood. They're probably Patricia Cornwell fans. And with that, it's time to switch over to the Consumer Reports. Last week we were talking about mattresses and pillows and the like. So let's take a look at further comments they have as far as sleep is concerned. Sick and tired of not being able to sleep soundly. Many Americans are using supplements, alcohol, and medications that not only don't work well, but also may be making them ill. Learn what's safe and effective. The explosion of the Challenger space shuttle, the Exxon Valdez oil spill, a warship collision in 2017 that claimed the lives of seven sailors. Implicated in all those incidents? A lack of sleep. Fatigue wreaks more havoc in our lives than we realize, says Daniel Boyos, MD, UPC professor of sleep medicine and psychiatry at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. Research suggests, for example, that if you have trouble sleeping, you're 60% more likely to be injured on the job than a colleague who sleeps well. And have you ever found your eyelids getting heavy while driving? Drowsy drivers cause about 10% of car wrecks, according to a 2018 report from the American Automobile Association Foundation for Traffic Safety. We ignore our biological clocks at our peril, Buoy says. Sleeplessness has become an American epidemic. 80% of U.S. adults say that they have trouble sleeping at least one night a week, according to the new Nationally Representative Consumer Report survey of 1,767 people. 4 out of 10 toss and turn most nights. Our survey found that sleeplessness affects people of all ages. The top complaint among millennials is falling asleep, while baby boomers are vexed more by waking up during the night. Women are slightly more likely to have received a diagnosis of insomnia, meaning they can't sleep despite ample time in bed. Men are more likely to receive a diagnosis of sleep apnea, a condition in which breathing stops briefly, repeatedly waking the sleeper. Regardless of age or gender, sleeplessness takes a toll. 30% of U.S. adults, an estimated 83 million people, told us that poor sleep negatively affects their quality of life. How long we sleep affects... Excuse me, I had turned the page. affects our hormones that regulate appetite, immune function, and the neural circuits of the brain that govern our ability to think and how we feel. It increases the risk of diabetes, high blood pressure, obesity, and heart disease. How you sleep affects literally everything, he says. Hidden but common causes. Our lack of sleep stems mainly from societal, not physical problems, says Michael Soteria, M.D., professor of emeritus of psychiatry at the Geisel School of Medicine at Dartmouth. With the increasing demands of our occupations and family life and the incessant bombardment of media, we aren't giving ourselves the opportunity for adequate sleep. If you toss and turn despite consisting allowing 7 or 8 hours in bed, or if you feel tired during the day, consult a doctor. Common conditions such as anxiety, depression, and enlarged prostate, heartburn, and pain can keep you up. Or you may need to adjust the type, timing, or dosage of a medication you take. Steroids, blood pressure drugs, and allergy and cold medications, for example, can act as stimulants to interfere with sleep. If you share a bedroom, your partner can provide clues. Snoring and gasping for breath can indicate sleep apnea. Excessive movement, restless leg syndrome. To investigate, your doctor may suggest an overnight test or refer you to a sleep specialist. Little-known talk therapy. If those steps don't help, the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, AASM, recommends cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, CBT1, a form of counseling that identifies and replaces thoughts and behaviors that contribute to poor sleep as a first-line treatment. CBT1 is at least as effective as medications. The benefits are long-lasting, and it's manifestly safer than any pill, Ciatella says. But few people have heard of it, and even if they are aware of CBT1, it can be hard to find a trained therapist, he says. For advice, see Finding a Sleep Therapist on the facing page, and there's an article over here on how to find them, so we'll look at that later. The problem with pills. Sleeplessness is complicated, but many people crave a simple chemical solution. Nearly one-third of people who complained of sleep problems at least once a week said they had used an over-the-counter or prescription sleep drug in the past year. But many of these people don't get the rest they seek. About one-third reported very good or excellent sleep, and they often don't wake refreshed. Nearly 60% of people taking sleep drugs reported feeling drowsy, confused, or forgetful the next day. The evidence is strongest for prescription drugs, says Bries, who, along with Soteria and other researchers, reviewed 129 studies of sleep drugs for the most recent treatment guidelines from the AASM. But the benefits are modest, increasing sleep time by about 20 to 30 minutes. Most surprising, there's little research into the effectiveness of some of the sleep aids Americans turn to most often, including the antidepressant trazodone, sold only as a generic, and over-the-counter products. So it's hard to know whether they help. OTC drugs contain older antihistamines, such as diphenhydramine and Advil PM, and doxylamine and Unison sleep tabs, which can cause drowsiness as a side effect. More risk than reward. All sleep medications, including OTC versions, have side effects. Most commonly, that means you feel drowsy, means making you feel drowsy, dizzy, less mentally sharp, or more physically unsteady the next day. People have also reported experiencing hallucinations, having memory lapses, and performing activities such as driving or eating while asleep. While most sleep drugs, long-term use can lead to dependence, and abruptly stopping the drugs can lead to a rebound effect, where insomnia gets worse. Taking too much, combining different types of sleeping aids, or using them with other drugs or alcohol magnifies the risk. Our survey also found that more than 1 out of 10 Americans who use prescription drugs for sleep risk, took an opioid for that purpose. That's particularly dangerous, not just because opioids are addictive, but also because they can slow your breathing and make it more shallow. So when combined with alcohol or other sedatives, which have the same effect, you can stop breathing altogether, Boyes says. The survey also shows that people often ignore warnings not to take any sleep aids unless they can spend at least 7 hours in bed. After 4 or 5 hours, you can still have the drug circulating in your blood, so you'll be less alert at precisely the time you need to be doing things that require your concentration. The following are percentages of people who were surveyed. 80% say they have trouble sleeping at least once a week. 30% say poor sleep negatively affects their quality of life. 38% reported some kind of misuse at least once in the past year. and 50% took a sleeping drug without allowing for at least 7 hours of sleep at least once in the past year. The science of supplements. In CR survey, nearly one out of five people said they took supplements to help them sleep. These included valerian, chamomile, and especially melatonin, a hormone that your brain secretes at night to signal your body that it's time to wind down. While people in our survey reported fewer problems with sleep supplements than with drugs, these products still cause side effects. About a quarter of respondents said they were drowsy the next day, and 12% said they felt confused, distracted, or forgetful. People taking supplements were also far less likely to say the products helped them a lot than those who were taking OTC or prescription drugs. Still, melatonin may have limited but important uses, says Alcibiades Rodriguez, M.D., the medical director of the Comprehensive Epilepsy Center Sleep Center at New York University, especially for people older than 70, who tend to make less melatonin. It may also help people who tend to fall asleep at a time that's not in sync with their internal clock, shift workers, for example, or those suffering from jet lag. There's less evidence for other supplements or herbal sleep aids. A 2015 review of 14 studies found that people with insomnia who took the herbs valerian and chamomile, kava, and ruling didn't sleep significantly longer or better than those who took a placebo. Another sleep aid growing in popularity, CBD, cannabidiol, a compound extracted from cannabis plants, including marijuana and hemp. CBD does not, however, get you high. In a separate nationally representative 2018 CR survey, more than 2,000 people, 10% of people who had tried CBD, said they use it to improve deep sleep, and a majority of these people said it helped. Limited research in humans suggests that CBD may ease anxiety and improve sleep in people with chronic pain, but there is still no clear medical evidence that CBD helps with insomnia. Why a nightcap is a no-no. About as many Americans drink alcohol to help them sleep as take supplements, according to CR survey. Alcohol does make some people feel sleepy, but it disrupts sleep later on, says Jennifer Martin, Ph.D., Associate Professor of Medicine at UCLA. For example, alcohol can interfere with chemicals in your brain that govern waking and sleeping, could worsen apnea and snoring, or may make you need to get up to go to the bathroom more often. And consistently getting disrupted sleep can worsen a sleep disorder in some cases. This sets up a destructive loop in which people drink more to try to sleep through the night, not realizing that worsens the problem. A safer path to sleep. If you have an ongoing problem with sleep, make sure you're not sabotaging your shut eye by, for example, drinking caffeine late in the day, exposing yourself to bright lights near bedtime, or taking a smartphone to bed. If you can't solve the problem on your own, talk to your doctor before dosing yourself with OTC sleep aids. In general, drugs should be reserved for short-term insomnia, such as that caused by jet lag, anxiety after a stressful event. For sleeplessness lasting more than a few weeks, look for a physician certified in sleep medicine or ask your doctor about CBT1. Some people with severe sleep problems may benefit from taking a prescription sleep aid along with CBT1, tapering off as the therapy takes effect. But long-term use is typically not recommended. The drugs may become less effective over time, and in some cases people become hooked and can't stop. Very few people need sleep drugs long-term, Sotella says, and in those cases, patients should be monitored carefully to make sure that the drugs are still effective and they are not developing a dependence. Finding a sleep therapist. Cognitive behavior therapy for insomnia typically involves 4 to 6 sessions with a therapist who will coach you on strategy to improve sleep. Unlike drugs, the benefit of CBT1 lasts after therapy ends, says Jennifer Martin, Ph.D., a sleep psychologist at UCLA. It's best to work with a therapist certified in behavioral sleep medicine. Go to absm.org/bsmspecialist.aspx to find certified clinicians. Internet-based programs might also help some people. One is Sleepio, in which a virtual sleep expert guides you through 8 to 10 weeks, weekly sessions tailored to you. Sleepio is available in the U.S. only through certain insurers and employers and not as part of the research trials. If you're interested in enrolling, go to sleepio.com. A similar program, Shuti, that's S-H-U-T-I, myshuteye.com is also looking for research volunteers. Martin also suggests trying a free approach called CBT1 Coach. The data breach. Data breaches are a huge company. It's like Equifax, Facebook's, and Marriott Starwood hotels get all the attention. But a CR investigation shows that incidents of small businesses should worry consumers just as much. Here's how to protect yourself from the data breach next door. Chocolate can melt, says Allison Myers, head of sales for the Lake Champlain Chocolates in Burlington, Vermont, with a laugh. Normally, that's what passes for an emergency here. But in September 2017, the family-owned confectioner found itself immersed in a different kind of crisis. The company suffered a data breach in which hackers stole names, addresses, email addresses, and credit card information for some of its customers. Data breaches were in the news that month. Just days earlier, Equifax, one of the world's biggest data brokers, had suffered a major loss of data. The Equifax breach exposed the data of 148 million users. Lake Champlain Chocolates breach, just 90. But for the individuals whose information was compromised, the consequences weren't so different. Once their personal data is stolen, consumers are more vulnerable to crimes such as identity theft and spear phishing emails that can trick even cautious people into revealing credit cards and social security numbers, along with login credentials for social media or bank accounts. Lake Champlain Chocolates moved quickly to address the incident. It was very isolated, but we needed to make it seriously, Meyer said. The company patched the software vulnerability that made the breach possible. Then the Lake Champlain Chocolates mailed a letter to each of its affected customers, offering to help from an outside security consultant in reviewing their credit files. The company also reported the instance to Vermont's Attorney General, along with the Attorneys General of Maryland and New Hampshire. Those states require notification if it's likely that any residence information has been misused. We hope to make this right, read the letter to Andrew Minitsky, the company's attorney. However, that kind of swift action in contacting both consumers and law enforcement is unusual, security experts say. There is almost zero incentive to report this stuff, says Casey Oppenheim, CEO of Disconnect, a cybersecurity firm that often partners with Consumer Reports on projects that test security and privacy, so most small companies don't bother. Breaches behind closed doors. Huge data breaches like the ones at Equifax in 2017 and Marriott Starwood Hotels in 2018 can each affect hundreds of millions of people. But added together, small incidents might pose an equally big problem for consumers. Privacy Right Clearinghouse, an advocacy group, maintains a database of breaches going back to 2005 that lists 8,980 incidents. Of that total, 8,448, or 94%, affected fewer than 100,000 consumers. Yet in total, nearly 50 million consumers were caught up in these smaller incidents. They include everything from hacks, such as the Lake Champlain Chocolates event, to unintended disclosures, in which potentially sensitive information was accidentally posted publicly, mishandled, or sent to the wrong party. Unintended disclosures account for roughly 20% of all the breaches in the PRC database. This past fall, Consumer Reports notified 251 people in our 36 million member records that their payment card number may have been inadvertently printed in the name or address line of their mailing label due to a technical error. When we discovered the error, we immediately worked to investigate how it occurred, assess and correct the case, and put measures in place to help make sure it does not happen again. Consumer Reports believe that high standards for data privacy and security are critical. We apply those same standards to ourselves. PRC's information is drawn from government agencies and news reports, and the group says that many unintended disclosures and small data breaches remain hidden. We don't really know how many small data breaches there have been, says Emery Rowan, PRC's policy counsel, but the number of victims is much, much higher than 50 million. Statistics don't matter much if your personal data has fallen into the hands of cyber criminals. We talk to victims, and in their experience, the size of the data breach is completely irrelevant, says Eva Velasquez, president and CEO of the Identity Theft Resource Center, a nonprofit that helps data breach victims. They're in the same boat whether they're in the 1 in 1 million or 1 in 10,000 or only 1 in 10. One thing that does matter is hearing about the data breach quickly. That alerts consumers to keep a tight watch on credit card bills and suspicious emails. It can prompt them to change passwords and freeze credit reports. and notifying officials can help them catch cyber criminals and warn other businesses of emerging dangers. If consumers don't know about a breach because it wasn't reported, they can't take action to protect themselves, Oppenheim says. Why small businesses get hit? Small businesses are low-hanging fruit for hackers, says Candid Wuest. That's an interesting name. W-U-E-E-S-T. Wuest, I guess it's pronounced. A threat researcher at the securities response firm Semnatech. A local retailer may hold the same kind of valuable consumer data as a Fortune 500 company and face the same hackers armed with the same software tools. Cyber attacks are often automated, hitting many servers at once, and so hundreds of small businesses may get caught up for every one major company that's affected. And these businesses have fewer defenses. It's an unfair fight, Voice says. Small companies don't have a dedicated chief information security officer to combat hacking, just an average Joe who looks after the printer. A small business breach can often be traced to simple stuff. For instance, Lake Champagne Chocolates failed to install a software update on the day it was released. But hackers can also apply a human touch through social engineering. If an employee responds to a phishing email, an urgent request that seems to come from the CEO, or a file that appears to be a sales report, the entire business can be compromised. A failure to report. Steve, Stasikluk, and Onus can hear panic in their voices. The calls come to the info security consultant a few times a week, when business owners discovered often from their customers that they've been hacked. The panic usually subsides. This is an interesting name, too. Stasenukonis says, but tensions can rise again when it's time for what he calls the uncomfortable conversation. Stasenukonis was recently contacted by a church that had fallen victim to an attack that compromised congregation data. He urged the pastor to reach out to the congregation and law enforcement officials. But the pastor pushed back. Our parishioners give us money, so it's not like they're buying something from me, he argued. After that, the church cut off contact with Stasikonosis. As far as he knows, kept the breach quiet. The experience wasn't unusual, he said. The upfront cost of responding to a data breach can run into the hundreds of thousands of dollars once you factor in lawyers and services such as credit monitoring for consumers. Meanwhile, sales can slow down or grind to a halt while the company struggles to get the situation under control. But the biggest problem comes later. Not bringing in new clients because your reputation is tainted. That's what leads to companies going out of business, said Nikolai Varga, chief technology officer for SwitchFast, an IT service provider in Chicago that works with small businesses. According to a 2017 study by the Better Business Bureau, a data breach could render more than half of all small businesses insolvent within a month. That rarely seems to happen with large companies. Equifax, Home Depot, and Target took publicity hits after their data breaches, but then recovered. Small data breach solutions. What can be done about the epidemic of small data breaches? Experts say you can protect yourself by limiting the amount of data you provide and taking such steps as freezing your credit and maintaining strong, unique passwords for each online account. Act as though you've been involved in a data breach, even if you haven't been notified of one. Nationally, consumer advocates and security experts are calling for legal reforms. Security laws in this country are relatively weak and probably insufficient incentives for companies to take data security and data breach notifications seriously, says Justin Brookman, Director of Consumer Privacy and Technology Policy for Consumer Reports. All 50 states have data breach laws, and a number of them have passed within the past year. However, Brookman says the provisions vary widely and enforcement is very uneven. One guidepost for new and more effective privacy laws could be the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, or HIPAA, which requires medical facilities to safeguard patient confidentiality and promptly report any data breach. HIPAA has its shortcomings, but experts agree that doctors and hospitals take the data protection provisions very seriously. HIPAA's violations can result in large fines or the blocking of Medicare reimbursements. The most serious violations can land an individual in prison. That could be why medical data breaches account for 46% of the small incidents captured by the Privacy Clearance Out database. Even small healthcare incidents get reported. One record shows that on November 30, 2017, a laptop bag containing a backup hard drive was stolen from a dentist office in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Much of the data was encrypted, and the risk of the thief accident was very small. Nevertheless, the office followed HIPAA requirements by informing both patients and the authorities. Small businesses aren't all waiting for stricter laws to tighten their digital security. Lake Champlain Chocolates has come to realize that it's not just in the truffle business, it's in the data business too. We started out as a mom and pop making candy, but being in business today requires a different level of sophistication, Myers says. Consumer privacy and data security, we have to take them seriously as the chocolate that we love. Seven steps to more data security. Just say no. Be stingy with personal information, advises Justin Bookman, Consumer Reports Director of Consumer Privacy and Technology Policy. The less data you give out, the less there is to be stolen. Consumers aren't obliged to comply with every request of personal data. Guard Mom's maiden name. Since crooks can search online for details such as your mother's maiden name or where you attended elementary school, use memorable but fictitious details for online security questions. Be unique. Using strong passwords is a must, but it's just as critical to use different ones for each site. If you don't want cyber criminals to luck into your banking password if they happen to hack into your favorite site for cute socks, write it down. In a perfect world, you commit your hard-to-hack 11-character alphanumeric passwords to memory. It ain't a perfect world. If you don't have nosy roommates, just write down your password in a secure spot, Brookman says. Experts also recommend digital password managers. Use a burner email. Create a separate email address for one-time purchases and for logging into the occasional ukulele chat group. That will limit the risk to email addresses you use for more sensitive activities. Freeze your credit reports. You can do this free of charge at all of the major credit bureaus, which would make it tough for criminals to get a credit card or mortgage on your home in your name. You can temporarily unfreeze the reports if you need to take out a loan yourself. Monitor accounts. Look for suspicious activity or financial accounts or contact institutions immediately with any questions. The Identity Theft Resource Center has detailed advice for conserving data breaches and identity theft. And how about a little info on a road report? My phone navigation app is hard to see when I'm driving. Any ideas? So-called heads-up display devices that project transparent directions onto the lower part of your windscreen can be a good solution for cars that don't have Android Auto, Apple CarPlay, or built-in heads-up display. Some devices pair wirelessly with your smartphone and run on an app. Others must be connected to a car's OBD2 port. They range in price from about $15 to more than $300. Be sure your device is securely fastened to prevent it from flying around the car in the event of a collision. Never heard of that. That's cool. Mercedes-Benz cars and SUVs. Mercedes-Benz is recalling 104,600 of its 2018 C-Class sedans, coupes, and convertibles, and 2018-2019 GLC SUVs because a faulty passenger airbag light can indicate that the airbag is engaged when it's not, raising the risk of injury to passengers. What to do? Mercedes will perform a software update to ensure the airbag light is working correctly, at no charge to owners. For more information, contact Mercedes-Benz USA at 800-367-6372. 79% percentage of car owners with blind spot monitoring who don't know that the safety system may not accurately detect vehicles traveling at high speeds as when merging onto a busy highway. Save money on GM cars. General Motors is eliminating six cars from its lineup due to poor sales. Two of these, the Chevrolet Cruze and the Impala, are recommended by CR and earned high overall scores. Smart shoppers could save thousands on them when production winds down this spring for the Cruze, summer for the Impala. Here's what we like about each. The Chevy Cruze. It's roomy for a compact car and has decent fuel economy, a comfortable ride, an overall score of 71. Impala. This cruiser has an overall score of 86 and gets good marks for ride and seat comfort, easy-to-use controls, and trunk space. Both cars come with GM's 3-year, 36,000-mile bumper-to-bumper and 5-year, 60,000-mile powertrain warranties. Many GM vehicles share key components, so parts and service should be readily available for years to come. And here's a few recalls to finish out our time here today. 2008 to 2019 Toyota and Lexus models. Toyota is recalling 89,740 of the 2008 to 2019 Toyota Land Cruisers and Lexus LX570 SUVs because the seatbelt tension sensor wire harness may break and deactivate the front passenger airbag, knee airbag, and passenger seat mounted side airbag. If that happens, the airbags won't deploy as expected in a crash, increasing the risk of injury. What to do? Toyota owners can call 888-270-9371, and Lexus owners can call 1-800-255-3987 for updates. The recall reference numbers are Toyota Interim J15 and Remedy J05, and Lexus Interim J2L and Remedy JLL. Ford, Lincoln, and Mercury models 2010 to 2014. Ford has recalled 782,384 of the 2000 Ford Edge and Lincoln MX SUVs, 2010-2011 Ford Ranger pickup trucks, 2010-2011 Mercury Milan cars, 2010-2012 Ford Fusion and Lincoln MKZ cars, and 2010-2014 Ford Mustang sports cars as part of the ongoing recall of a defective Takata airbag inflators. Dealers will replace the passenger frontal airbag inflator or module at no cost to owners. Call Ford at 866-536-7332. Ford's recall reference number is 19501. And let's finish up with a little bit of humor in uniform. It was basic training, and I was settled in the barber chair, bemoaning the impending loss of my hair, when the barber asked, "Where are you from?" "St. Louis," I grumbled. "Hey, I'm from St. Louis, too," he said. He then asked conspiratorially, "Do you want to keep your sideburns?" I perked up. "Sure." With that, he revved up the razor, clipped off my sideburns, and gave them to me. As I left the barber shop with sideburn in hand, I heard him ask his next victim, "Where are you from?" "Chicago." "Hey, I'm from Chicago, too." Steve Finkelstein, Plano, Texas. During KP duty, my sergeant ordered me to prepare 100 gallons of soup for that night's dinner. When I told him I had no clue how to make soup, he handed me a cookbook and instructed to follow the directions carefully. Not long after I had a large kettle of soup simmering, the sergeant came in, grabbed a spoon, and took a taste. "This is really good," he said. "Are you sure you followed the recipe?" And with that, we've run out of time for today's broadcast of the Reader's Digest Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. We would like to thank all of our past sponsors for their generous contributions to the Reading Service. If you have any comments or questions or would like to be a sponsor, please call us at 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. So long until next time, and thanks so much.